The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, Manchester is red and a collection of other colours with a lot of grey. But United win the derby, two wins for Solskjaer then. Is he good? Is Fred good? Is the class of 19 better than the class of 92? Okay, perhaps that's too far. Elsewhere, it's closed the goal of the season award already. Time as Heung-min Son runs past the whole of Burnley and Luis Suarez backheels some tiki-taka into the net. Big Dunk makes his men play like Big Dunk and hugs everyone in sight. Leicester keeps setting records and Newcastle are 10th. In Scotland, Celtic's one offside shot on target robs penalty-missing Rangers in the League Cup. We'll round up Europe, talk chess grandmasters, find out if Barry's still alive, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Flo Lloyd-Hughes. Nice to see you.
Hello, Max.
Are you well?
I'm all right. A bit sleepy, but I'm well.
Okay. Try and, you know, at what point, if you're feeling like falling asleep, I'd suggest perhaps the Watford-Crystal Palace game. George Ellick from Not the Top 20 podcast. How are you?
Yeah, very good, Max. How are you?
Yeah, pleased. And also good to see that when we tweeted you were on this time, no one responded with, is this George Ellicobe? So perhaps...
Much fewer. But not so good for George Ellicobe, though.
Not so good for him, but we don't care about the Maidstone centre-back as much as we care about you.
Thank you, John Bruin. Hello.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
Yeah.
That's it, really.
That's it. That's all we need. Let's start the Etihad then. Manchester City 1, Manchester United 2. And we arguably didn't give Manchester United enough credit on Thursday's pod after they beat Spurs. But they were excellent on Saturday. City didn't really have an answer in the first half. John, how did United do that?
The simple fact would be that their attackers had the pace and skills to trouble Manchester City's rather dodgy defence. And in centre midfield, my hero, Scott McTominay, returned. But even he was overshadowed by Fred, who put in the performance that, if you recall, going back to summers ago, one of the players that Pep Guardiola wanted to sign was Fred. And we saw signs of that player in that game. He'd actually played very well against Tottenham as well. And it was a total barnstorming performance from him. And credit has to go to Manchester United. I saw a nice picture of Ollie and Mike Phelan and Alex Ferguson sharing a glass of wine after. Ferguson always appears at these moments, doesn't he? But
to be fair to Fergie, he did appear at quite a lot of bad moments when you know they conceded a goal under David Moyes, and it would cut to Fergie.
Fergie in a flat cap in the stand at Stoke.
Do you think Fergie's running things?
No, as Ole Gunnar would always put it, he's at the end of the phone if I need him. And let's flip it around to City for just a little bit. They've got big problems. One of them is that Fernandinho cannot be. Well, there can't be two of him, and I'm not sure he's even that great a central defender. Rodri is not having the greatest of times, and poor old Angelino, a player they bought last summer, bought him back because he helped fulfil a quota as much as anything else, isn't up to the job either.
Back to United for a second. Flo, is this Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's finest moment as United manager?
Possibly. Solskjaer's a weird one because he always seems to kind of pull it back just as it seems like he could be on the way out. He just rescues things out of nowhere. I mean, obviously, they lost that game to Bournemouth. They brought things back against Sheffield United. He just somehow rescues things out of nowhere. And even though City are struggling, I was still surprised by the result. Getting a derby win in his short tenure is definitely, a big highlight for him. I just don't see where he's going with this role and with the club. Like, where can he take them is what I don't really understand.
Can't you see sort of shoots of potential here? You know, you see, going forward, they're exciting. And when that midfield is working well, they're quite a pleasure to watch. And I don't think I've said that about Manchester United for quite a long time.
That's true. I mean, obviously, Mourinho's United weren't that enjoyable to watch at all. And he definitely plays, and we definitely get some playing quite a loose, sort of frantic and exciting style. And maybe that's kind of what they need and what the fans need after kind of being a little bit sort of bored under Mourinho.
Or is it a case, George, that he does enough to make everybody go, okay, he can have it till the end, and then
Yeah, I mean, it strikes me that United's strengths under Solskjaer aren't necessarily down to Ole Gunnar. I mean, they've got individual quality around the pitch that should negate. I mean, these performances should happen. Marcus Rashford, Anthony Martial. I mean, these are players that teams are not going to want to face. Dan James's pace on the right hand side as well. But here, and I've been critical of Solskjaer in the past, but this felt like actually a bit of a tactical victory for him because they were very happy out of possession to sit in and let City have the ball, and then they broke with pace and enabled, as you said, Fred McTominay also to support the attacks. And it felt like he kind of outthought Pep in the first half, which is something I never thought I would say because I think the quality gap between the two is obviously massive. And this is the ninth game in a row now that City haven't kept a clean sheet going back to the end of October. I remember going to a game, I think, three seasons ago in that second season away at West Ham. And they played Sterling and Jesus and Sane, who are all probably about 20 or 21 years old, and they completely tore West Ham apart. And it feels like this is now the team at the end of the cycle where those players have come through. I mean, Sane's obviously injured, but they've come through and they're now fulfilling their potential. And there's not that next generation really coming through. Phil Foden is it, but the fact that Guardiola's seemingly choosing not to play him is maybe significant in itself. And it just feels like Guardiola's time at City is starting to wind up, and that this could be, I guess, the beginning of the end for him. I mean, it's not going to be a case where they're going to dispense of him, but we all know that Guardiola is not someone who sticks around in a job for more than three or four seasons.
So what is City's plan now, Flo? Win the Champions League? That's what they've got to try and do, isn't it?
I don't see them winning the Champions League.
No, I don't either. But I mean, that's what, you know, Pep, because Pep, you know, I know he said a couple of weeks ago, winning doesn't really matter, you know. And, you know,
it's hilarious.
It was hilarious, wasn't it? But he's got to be going sort of slightly mad at the moment.
Yeah, I think this season there's easy sort of scapegoats for him as well. I mean, he's got VAR to talk about. He's got obviously all the injuries, which to be fair have been, you know, really tough for his side. So there are sort of excuses which he can lean on. And maybe in January, you know, the ownership will, if he wants them to, will back him if he wants to maybe continue his career there and buy in some new players, buy in some defenders, which they're desperate for. But it's whether or not he sees himself in that position, because there's no point in him, you know, getting the players he wants in if he's just going to, in the summer, leave and then someone else has got to then work with that.
This does happen a bit with Pep, though, where he starts to fall out of love with his players. Mm. It happened at Barcelona. Mm. It certainly happened at Bayern, and it seems to be happening now where he gets this squad together and then he's dissatisfied, but it costs so much to build them. And
who do you think he's out of love with? Mahrez?
Well, definitely Otamendi and Stones.
Mm-hmm, true.
Mahrez, yes, you'd have to say. Phil Foden, even though he said he's the bestest player in the world ever.
All the fullbacks, you have to say as well. He can't seem to make up his mind who plays where and when. I mean, there's no first choice, really, is there? It's just a rotation.
I think Mahrez was such a surprising buy in the first place, and I didn't think he was going to hang around City for long because he doesn't seem like the kind of player that Pep would want to work with. He seems, from the outside looking in, an absolute personality clash straight away. So I was really surprised as to why he brought him into the team, because it doesn't seem like he wants to fit him in.
Well, that's shades of when Barcelona bought Alexis Sanchez and he completely wasn't a Pep Guardiola player, though weirdly enough he wanted to buy him again. So
who knows?
Pep can be fussy, but then can change his mind. Is entitled to do that.
Look, VAR worked. We'll talk about it in detail a bit later, unfortunately. But I don't know what Bernardo Silva is doing. There's no need to do that challenge. Is it just because City are that scared of Marcus Rashford? And that's what happens when
it's just a player who's not very good at defending, trying to defend in his own box, I think. It's just a case of mistimed. Rashford was too quick for him.
And Edison got some criticism for the second goal. It is possible, don't you think, to get beaten at your near post and it not be your fault? I mean, the ball was right in the corner. He's not expecting, it's coming through a crowd of players as well. There was another one, I think Alex Tetti scored one, didn't he, for Norwich, it was at the near post, but he hit it so hard that you sort of think sometimes, you know, the goalkeeper is not as big as the goal, right? He's allowed to sometimes let it in at the near post, or am I giving Edison a free pass?
Especially when he'd kept them in it, largely up to that point as well. He'd made two decent saves to keep the scoreline at 1-0. And I agree, it was a well-hit shot placed into that bottom corner. And, you know, you're always going to look at the keeper when it goes in at the near post.
With stuff like that, there's always a certain amount of artistic impression, isn't there? The fact that he didn't get close to it at all makes it look worse.
Well, I think he was quite close to it.
Yeah, but, well, it wasn't close enough, obviously.
Well,
but
it wasn't, no, John.
But it's it looked worse than it was. It was obviously a very sharp finish by Martial. But again, I suppose we'll flip it around a little bit, and that the fact that we expect Edison to save that probably just shows you how good a goalkeeper he is.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you set those standards, then you're going to expect him to keep so much out. But like George said, they've been struggling for clean sheets recently, but that's not really down to Edison. It's down to the people in front of him who, you know, he can't really do much about that.
No. Oh, you know, I'm an Oxford fan, and in 10 days' time, we've got City in the Carabao Cup quarterfinals, and I fancy our chances to score. Like, I watch them and I think we're going to get chances because they play with such a high line. And
Bravo will probably be playing as well.
Exactly. Just shows how far it's come now, because realistically, for a League One team, Man City should be unbeatable.
Now, a man's been arrested in connection with the allegations of racist abuse by a supporter during the game. A video circulating on social media appeared to show a Manchester City fan making monkey chants towards Manchester United players during the second half of the match. Greater Manchester Police announced on Sunday morning that a 41-year-old man's been arrested on suspicion of a racially aggravated public order offence. Remains in custody for questioning. The man's been named in reports as Anthony Burke, who, according to his since removed Facebook page, works for the construction company Kia Group. In now deleted posts on his Facebook page, Burke denied that he was a racist, having tweeted on Saturday evening to say it was aware of the video. Kia announced on Sunday that an employee has been suspended. The FA is planning to talk to the clubs, the referee Anthony Taylor, the police and other relevant parties. It's understood United reported the incident to City and Taylor, with more than one of the players feeling they had abuse of a racist nature aimed at them. City released a statement saying the club operates a zero-tolerance policy regarding discrimination of any kind, and anyone found guilty of racial abuse will be banned from the club for life. As we've said on this pod before, we are going to continue to report these incidents, and we are going to follow up on the special we did after the Bulgaria-England game later in the season. On a complete gear change and unrelated, Jen says, who is the most likely on the pod to wear a Micah Richards multi-zip style jacket? Did you see Micah in the Sky studio? That was quite a formidable piece of loungewear. For me, zips are on an anorak and not on a suit, but Flo, you're the youngest, you know, you're the coolest amongst us.
I mean, I'm always baffled by some of the choices that come out in the Sky studio, and I don't know if it's the on-set stylist or the players are choosing it themselves, but there's often a colour clash, at least, in some of the attire. Or stripes, which, you know, if you work in TV, that is just a big no-no.
You don't want a strobe.
No.
Although, look, back in the Sky days...
Yeah, I'd like to see some of your outfits back.
Back in our... I mean, I don't want to see any of those videos tweeted out for lots of reasons, actually, but back in the Sky days, yes, you did have... I'd go shopping twice a year, and I'd just try and buy blue jumpers, and that was much safer. But occasionally they'd try and put me, because I was on a fun show, I would be putting, you know, occasionally, you know, those jumpers that are too long to be jumpers, things like that, that I couldn't really pull off.
I'm just a Don Goodman man. He's the snappiest man.
Do you think Don's got it?
He's got it, hasn't he? And sort of 70s style camel coat.
Yeah, big lapels. I thought Micah Richards, to be fair, I think is a brilliant pundit, actually.
He's good, yeah.
And he took on Roy Keane as well. He wasn't having any nonsense, saying, you know, hang on a second, I really enjoyed that. Anyway, back to the football. To Goodison, Everton 3, Chelsea 1. George, was Duncan Ferguson the most enjoyable thing about the weekend's football? Just hugging ball boys, running down the touchline. I almost sort of choked up at the end when I saw him clapping the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, you have to love the romance of Duncan Ferguson getting that result. You have to also doubt whether or not he's going to be the guy to take them forward. And I was watching it with a friend of mine who's a Chelsea fan, and we were saying that it's one of those performances and results that could be bad long term if Everton get caught up in this idea that Big Dunk's going to be the guy to take them forward after this and give them the full time job, because there are going to be better candidates out there. But in terms of this game and what Everton as a club needed, to be galvanised like that at Goodison, to see, I mean, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but seeing the place rocking as it was, and they showed the clips of the crowd and everyone, you know, it looked absolutely electric. And the Marco Silva era, especially towards the end, just felt pretty dour, with very little to get excited about whatsoever. So, you know, whilst I'm not necessarily sure that Ferguson's the man to lead Everton kind of through this period long term, I think this result and this performance and seeing, you know, his antics on the touchline, and he was even wearing, you know, Howard Kendall's watch as well, on his wrist, in order to doff of the cap to him, which is a lovely story. So,
but I mean, it's such a cliche that players will play for someone or even like someone because they have passion. But you know, Adam Bate from Sky has a stat. Everton made 37 tackles in that game. That's more than any Premier League side this season, more than Everton have done in the last decade. Not cumulatively, I should point out, but...
Well, it did seem that Big Dunk had gone back to the Dogs of War days from the mid-90s. You at least may recall them.
I do, yeah.
Yes, with Joe Parkinson trundling around midfield, kicking everything that moved. Paul Rideout up front. Funny enough, Big Dunk was a bit of a flair player in that team.
There was a great moment, I'm sure it was when Graham Stewart was playing for Everton. When
Cristiano Ronaldo
was just doing lots of stepovers and just stepovers. And Stewart went, oh, sod it, and just kicked him really hard.
Well, yeah, and Duncan Ferguson, I mean, they played 4-4-2, so they went straight back to the basics. The one thing you would say is, though, that... it wasn't as if Duncan Ferguson was just parachuted in from nowhere. He has been at the club as a coach for 7 years. One of his biggest hugs of the many was given a sort of group hug for Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Tom Davis, two players that played for him as a youth manager. So everyone at that club knows what Duncan Ferguson's about. I think the thing is, though, that having got that result, it does buy Everton's board, who, let's say, aren't the most decisive of decision makers, it buys them a bit of time, and they've got this folk hero in charge. The problem that they don't want is to go down what happened 2 years ago or so with David Unsworth, where he was there and then it all started coming apart, and then someone had to press the button called Sam Allardyce. So
is there that button in every mid-table Premier League club?
There's got to be.
It's just his head. It's a massive button with his head. Why wouldn't you just keep with him until this wears off, right? They're talking to this guy, Vitor Pereira, who's out in China getting paid squillions of pounds over there. By all accounts, they were looking to bring him in sort of now, and they may do, but wouldn't you think, listen, you know, they've got some interesting games. They go to Old Trafford, they've got Leicester in the Carabao, they've got Arsenal. If they might as well ride this wave until it crashes, right?
Yes. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that it looks like they've got a safe pair of hands at the very least. I would say that there's also going to be some troubles that comes alongside playing a 4-4-2 for the next few weeks, because then if some continental coach does come in, he's going to have a bit of a shock when he's tried to change the system to whatever he's going to want to play. And there are enough warning signs. I mean, every season, we see it, especially in the Championship and League One, where a manager will be sacked, he'll be replaced by an interim coach, he'll get a couple of good results, and then the worst decision the club can make is to give him the job full-time. And I think the Manchester United are living that out at the moment, even if they did get a great result on the weekend. Arsenal, I think, is unlikely going to do the same given the start that Freddie Ljungberg's made. But you know, a good performance here or there, the freedom that these players are playing under when they've, you know, a manager who they quite clearly weren't performing under has gone, shouldn't be a massive surprise, and that shouldn't necessarily be down to Ferguson himself. So safe pair of hands, yes. By all means, ride the wave. But if there's someone out there who's better with a better track record available, don't be blinded by the caretaker coach.
Dominic Calvert-Lewin played like Duncan Ferguson, didn't he? With his first brace in the league since October 2015, when he scored twice for Northampton Town in a 3-2 win against Carlisle. Chelsea had chances, but they didn't really turn up. They've lost 3 in 4. Are the wheels falling off? Is Jonathan Wilson actually right? And now that the Cass has halved that transfer window ban, so the transfer window opens in January, they've reduced the fine as well. Do they go and buy lots of players?
I think Lampard will be relieved about that ruling, because I think even though he's done really well with the, you know, what he had, they definitely do need some reinforcement. I was surprised at the job that Lampard was doing, because I didn't think he was a particularly impressive coach at Derby. I think, you know, they had some great loanee players who sort of kept them in that playoff chase. I didn't think they were a particularly impressive team. So I do think he's punching above his weight a little bit, and maybe he's just being found out. But at the same time, you have to say, well, you know, at parts there, you haven't got a lot to work with, and maybe he's been slightly sort of, you know, saved by the performances of Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham, who have been doing exceptionally well this season, and probably without them, you know, it could have been worse than where they are now.
But is he going to send them out on loan again in January?
I don't think it's that bad, and I think the fans are really enjoying it, even though it's not quite the success they've had over the past few years. That, you know, they love Lampard, and it's it's exciting and frantic football. So, you know, if they lose a few games, I don't think, you know, it's the end of the world for them at the moment. Obviously, given their history, they will want to push on at some point. And whether Lampard's the man to do that right now, I'm not so sure.
Before we move on to Spurs, a statement from Everton. Everton is working in conjunction with Kick It Out and has commenced an investigation into homophobic chanting reported during Saturday's Premier League game against Chelsea. Both the club and Kick It Out have received reports of a homophobic chant being aimed at Chelsea fans by a small section of the home crowd. Homophobia has no place within our stadium, our club, our community or our game. The club strongly condemns such behaviour and is carrying out a thorough investigation, which will include liaison with Merseyside Police. This follows on from Kick It Out receiving numerous reports of homophobic chanting at Stamford Bridge by West Ham fans during Chelsea's last home game. Kick It Out said last week in a statement, "We've informed the FA and reiterate our message. The Rent Boy chant is homophobic and must be treated as such." To the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, Tottenham 5, Burnley 0. Well then, what an assist from Jan Vertonghen. That goal from Sun Heung-min, right? He picks the ball up on the edge of his own box. He beat eight men. He ran 90 yards in 15 seconds, took 12 touches, had the composure to score the goal. The sad thing is to think that if I just had a race with him with nobody in my way and no ball and no goal to score, he'd still have beaten me. What a thing of total beauty, John.
Yeah, the goal I've seen it compared to is that it's a goal by Ronaldo, the old elder Ronaldo. Mm,
Jose compared it to that.
Yes, yes. And it also reminded me of a goal which was on 101 great goals, which was George Best against Sheffield United from about 71 or something. Sideburns are going. And just flying through this team and then scoring in that manner. It one of those things where he sets off and then it's like, oh, this is happening. And it's just incredible. And the thing is, the two goals that Harry Kane scored in that game were absolutely fantastic too. So, you know, if you're a Spurs fan, that's what a day out that was.
Do you think... I mean, I don't want to take away from the goal because the Burnley attempts to challenge him were like a sort of scene from Goal 3, weren't they? but like where his touch is, it's, you know, when you watch a footballer do something brilliant and you don't know if that is just pure skill, that he's put the right pace on the ball to drag the defender towards him, so the defender's got a decision to make, because if he keeps the ball close to his feet, the defender doesn't have a chance. Is that luck or skill? Or
I think it's skill. I mean, it looked to me, when he picks up the ball and he kind of takes a couple of strides forward, he looks up in his own half. It looks to me like he thinks to himself, like, okay, yeah, this is what I'm going to do now, because he can see in front of him that there's obviously a route to goal. And so I think he knows there that he's just going to drive as fast and as long as possible. And he's got the pace to burn off anyone. And you said, you know, he would beat you in a sprint. Well, he did that to 10 Burnley players. He just absolutely burnt past them. Brilliant, brilliant goal. And he's such a special player. I think he's one of those players who probably doesn't get the credit he deserves in a general world stage. And he is someone who we might look back on when he gets a move to a, you know, a Real or a Barca, and we think back and remember him in the Premier League and didn't realise how good he was.
The Guardian had done the top 100 footballers and you have to send in your top 40, and I panicked that I'd completely missed him out. But I put him 10th. Is that, and I might be biased, and I don't expect you to have exactly where you'd put him in the sort of gamut of footballers right now, but where is he, Flo?
I would maybe go top 25. Right. I think also for someone like him, he's also had goals that have been really important goals, and that can also have a bit more of an impact. Yeah, it's great if you're scoring every week, but sometimes, you know, he has his moment. The times he scores, they're always special moments. That's what's amazing about Son. He doesn't really like doing sort of standard, easy goals. He always likes to score really, really difficult goals. And I think that's what puts him kind of a level above the rest. And also his personality. I know that's not necessarily a factor in who's the best footballer, but when you look at some of the... Maybe I shouldn't be specific with names, but you look at some of the characters in world football and their reputations. I mean, no, I don't think I've ever heard anyone say a bad word about him. He's just, you know, famously, you know, the nicest man in football. And I think that should give you a few bonus points.
Burnley conceded 9-2, three defeats in a row, 3 points off the bottom three. But I don't think anyone's worried about them. Should anyone be worried about them?
I think so.
Okay.
Because, I mean, Burnley... There's always this talk about how Turf Moor is a tricky place to go. Their record against the top six teams there recently has been absolutely terrible. And Sean Dyche these days, I think their bread and butter is trying to get past teams in the bottom half. So results like this aren't necessarily, you know, too much to get concerned about. But there are, I mean, pretty consistently now, they are going to be a team who will get beaten by the better teams in the league, who are going to struggle to score goals often in games. And I think they've lost a bit of that kind of tough nature. That goal we saw Son score is so against what we expect from this Burnley team, who don't give up space and don't let players run into them.
I did think someone could have kicked him over.
Well,
right?
that's kind of it, the streetwise nature that you think of Sean Dyche and this team. And you know, you look at the possession stats. I mean, they have more possession than Spurs. I mean, that probably has more to do with Jose Mourinho and the game state of being 2-0 down after 9 minutes. But at the same time, they just don't really feel to me like they're necessarily the Burnley of old. And you still look down at the bottom half of the Premier League table. And you've got teams, I mean, you've got Aston Villa, who've put in plenty of good performances this season, sitting in 17th position. They've only lost 3 games at home. And I'd be very surprised if Burnley aren't in that clutch of teams towards the bottom end of the table this season.
I think they need a hatchet man like Andreas Pereira.
Do you?
Yeah, it just comes on and just kicks
some people.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good idea, isn't it? They've won only 2 points in 10 games against teams above them, but dropped just 2 in 6 against the teams below them. So I suppose if they keep on that record, then they'll have just a disappointingly unsatisfactory time, but stay up.
So it's a massive game next. They've got their two next games are Newcastle at home and Bournemouth away.
Oh, 6-pointers.
And I think after those 2 games, we'll have a much better understanding if they are a team to be concerned about.
Sean Dyche's Burnley have hit flat spots over his time in the Premier League, and this appears to be one of them. Last season, it was at the start of the season. And then I think the previous season to that, it happened at the end of the season. So maybe this is that point. You would expect with having such an able manager and a decent squad, they would stay up. But I share George's concerns about them.
Okay. Are you concerned, Flo? I mean, I just two out of three.
I mean, I've never had much concern for Burnley.
No,
I think they're in trouble. But I think if you look at, you know, the rest of the weekend's fixtures, there's a lot of teams that are in trouble. Yeah. So they could be kind of the best of the worst.
Just for balance, I spend every waking minute concerning myself about Burnley. And that'll do for part one. We'll begin part two at the Vitality Stadium. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Some live shows coming up next Friday, 20th of December. We'll be in Leeds to sell out. Looking forward to seeing you alongside Lars, Jonathan Wilson, and one more, TBC. 20th of January, we're playing Brighton at the Salis Benny Theatre. Me, Barry, Ellis James, Nicky Bandini. And the 28th of January, still a couple of tickets left at Liberty Hall in Dublin. We've sold out the day before. Me, Barry, and two more. So thanks for buying some tickets. Bournemouth 0, Liverpool 3. Mikel says, Liverpool have 73 from the last 75 league points available. It's not a question. It should just be brought up how absurd this is. George, that is absurd, isn't it?
It's absolutely unbelievable. And the funny thing is, you'll speak to some football fans and some Liverpool fans who think that for quite a lot of that, they've been playing in kind of first gear. They don't really need to get out of it in order to win these games. You look at the game against Bournemouth, they were 3-0 up after 54 minutes. And even so, when you'd expect them maybe to concede a bit of possession or maybe let Bournemouth kind of into the game a little bit, Bournemouth had 3 shots in the whole match, none of them on target, 2 of them blocked and 1 of them miles wide. They were completely and utterly dominant over a team, you know, who aren't, you know, they're not necessarily relegation candidates. And it's just relentless dominance for Liverpool. And, you know, again, a rotation amongst the team with Oxlade-Chamberlain coming back in and playing in that front three and scoring a goal. Naby Keita coming in and getting on the score sheet as well. Joe Gomez coming in for Trent Alexander-Arnold and probably putting in a man-of-the-match performance. They have so much strength and depth and they are so confident in what they do that it's just impossible for me to see them slipping up anywhere near enough to let anyone back into this title race.
And what a glorious pass, Flo, from Jordan can't pass it forwards Henderson for Liverpool's opener. Lovely finish from the Ox as well.
Yeah, it was great to see Oxlade-Chamberlain sort of back in the team, obviously because of the kind of demand this festive season, Club World Cup. Klopp's doing well to sort of rotate his squad, which is great because, you know, people like Lallana and Oxlade-Chamberlain get another look. So, yeah, I think they're just unstoppable and so impressive. And you'd think, I mean, they can't throw it away now, surely. No.
I think in a way, it's probably good for Manchester United fans if Liverpool win this league early and they have a lot of time to sort of deal with it psychologically, rather than it being like a last day of the season type, you know, Aguero type moment. I was on the radio with Perry Groves yesterday, John, and he was saying this Club World Cup might actually, we were, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were, you know, Fabinho got injured and we were looking at, I think they'd just drawn in the Champions League and we were going, oh dear, now they've got that fixture and sort of all the fixture build up. And he was saying, actually, this might be like warm weather training. You know, the kids get experience in the Carabao Cup. They've got one probably pretty easy game in the Club World Cup. Then they sit in the sun. You know, they've got one tough game. And actually, it's like a winter break for them.
Well, the two examples I can think of where that did happen were Manchester United played in Japan in 2008. And if you remember that season, they were in a battle royale with Rafa Benitez's Liverpool. And they pretty much watched Benitez's Liverpool slip up while they were over in Japan. And a few years before that, in 2000, when they had that weird FIFA World Club Championship, which isn't quite like this one, but had a few more clubs in, which is probably a bit like the one that they're going to arrange in a couple of years. They sunned themselves in Rio, played beach football, you know, with kids from the favelas and had a good time. And meanwhile, the other teams challenging for the title that season, which would be 1999-2000, they watched Arsenal slip up and came back and won the title by, I think it was 18 points that season. So it can happen. It's always better, I think, in a title race to be actually leading. It's on the other teams to build up the pressure on them while they're away. And let's face it, other than Leicester, I don't really see that happening.
You said, George, that you don't think Bournemouth are relegation candidates, but that is five defeats in a row. They lost Nathan Ake. It was 0-0 when he went off. And, you know, he's a good player. I don't know if he is the difference between Bournemouth getting something from that game or not, but they're just above the relegation zone. They had an XG of 0.14. I think that means it would have taken them 8 or 9 games to score a goal, if XG means what it means. If we're worried about Burnley, we've got to be worried about Bournemouth.
Yeah, right? That's fair. And this seems to happen fairly consistently. Like, you mentioned the bad runs for Burnley. Bournemouth seem to go on these stretches under Eddie Howe where they just cannot defend and they cannot keep clean sheets.
And no one notices because it's Bournemouth.
No, I know.
And the same happens with Burnley. And then people think, oh God, they're down there. I mean, it's just because it's a smaller club and they don't often lead match of the day or anything like that. But yeah,
I agree. And yeah, there seems to be a bit of a, you know, you look at the team selection Eddie Howe made on Saturday and, you know, playing two up top in Solanke and Wilson against Liverpool, it's probably a little bit naive, you'd have to say, looking back now. They probably should have tried to keep it a bit tighter. And the current run of form is very, very troubling. I do think they've got the quality in the team that maybe Burnley don't. But Ake is such an important player for them that, you know, him going off injured, they'll be hoping that you know, he's not out for any long period of time. They go to Chelsea next. It's probably quite a good time to go to Stamford Bridge. We've spoken about how Chelsea are struggling at the moment. No, but you are right. I probably spoke incorrectly there. And you have to be.
Shame on you. Go below the line.
I mean, they're only 1 point above Southampton. And the narrative around those two teams has been very different. And I think Bournemouth are a side that get plagued by injuries. And they do impact, you know, quite heavily. So I'm more concerned about Bournemouth than Burnley. Okay. My concerns are on.
Sure, I see. Now, you said if Leicester can keep up the charge, let's talk about their game. They won 4-1 at Aston Villa. The game is brought to you by the number 8, 8th win in a row, a new club record. Vardy scored in 8 straight games. They are 8 points behind Liverpool. We need them to push Liverpool to keep this interesting. They have no European football. Can they keep it up, Flo?
I think so. I mean, they're not going to catch Liverpool, but I think they'll continue. They'll continue this form. It's just Rodgers has worked, you know, wonders on that team, and they're just playing with such confidence and arrogance. Jamie Vardy's in his absolute element. You know, a back four which, you know, compared to some of the other defenders in the league, isn't exactly standout, but are so solid. You know, keeping clean sheets for fun, more clean sheets than Liverpool have got recently. So they're just working like clockwork at the moment, and it is impressive, and the fans are loving it. It's a shame that, you know, it won't probably lead to any silverware, but, you know.
But I think the good thing about it is it doesn't feel like this is a flash in the pan. I think this is the beginning of an era for Leicester where they're going to be pushing for the top four consistently, because they've got the squad and they've got the investment and they've got the manager to do that. it always, that title winning season always felt like it was going to be a one-off and it was an incredible achievement, but the regression was going to happen. Whereas this is built on firm, like solid foundations, and they're not in any need to sell these players now as well. And you look at, you know, Pereira, the right back, is finally getting the credit that he deserves because he's up there with the best fullbacks in the league. And Didi, as that kind of box-to-box slash holding midfielder, his energy and his work rate around the pitch and his ball-playing ability is so, so strong. And then in Tielemans and Maddison, they've got the creative forces that would walk into any side in this league.
So is there now a big seven, or do we relegate, I don't know, Arsenal from the big six?
I'd say it's fluid, I think.
It's fluid,
it's
okay.
Fluid. It's a fluid table. Because it's, I think right now, to put Leicester and Arsenal in the same category is doing a massive disservice to Leicester.
That first goal, John, you know, Tyrone Mings must know. Anyone whose hamstring has gone on a football pitch, you know you can't run. So then for the first goal, he is basically on the six. He's so deep. And Engels, they've got to make that change. It just seems so... I can understand, you know, you sometimes you can roll an ankle or something and actually it feels all right and you can play on. But if your hamstring's gone, it's gone.
Well, I think Tyrone Mings is one of those players that will play through the pain barrier. So, unfortunately, his bravery counted against him and his team at that point. Also, Jamie Vardy in full flow. It's not the opponent you really want to be up against when you've got a hamstring problem, is it? and it's that first goal, it took a while in coming, weirdly. It was sort of various points where you thought...
Well, Villa missed a really good chance, didn't they? It was El Ghazi at the bar.
Yeah, well, I was actually referring to the goal. The fact that the goal was happening for a while.
Yeah.
And Vardy, it was like, is he going to score it? But the confidence, when Vardy's got that confidence, when he's on a scoring run, like he is now, like happened 3-4 seasons ago when they won the title, he isn't going to miss.
Hmm. Actually, his composure, you're right. To take that second touch once he's miss hit it is actually really, really good, isn't it? And Ian Acho as well, you know, Brendan Rodgers getting a tune out of someone that no one else has managed to get a tune out of.
I mean, Brendan's thing, his mantra over the... Well, he's been around for almost 10 years now, that, you know, a public figure, has been about improving players, and Ian Acho is one of the most striking examples of that I've seen from him.
Johnny Evans scored a brilliant header as well in that game. Heading is an underrated skill. They could have had 3 or 4 after that. Tom Heaton made some great saves and took one in the face from Soyuncu, which was fun. Brendan Rodgers used that Arsenal situation pretty well, didn't he, to get a new 5.5-year contract. Well done to him. That's just 2.5 years less than the Alan Pardew 8-year contract, which runs out next summer, by the way.
You feel like this one could be a little bit of a, you know, a shrewder move?
Possibly. Yeah. I mean, there's every chance, isn't there? now, prior to the game, there was a tribute to the former Villa boss, Ron Saunders, who's died at the age of 87. He led Villa to the league title in 1981. They just had 14 players. Also got the team to the quarterfinals of the European Cup the next season, only to resign abruptly after a major fallout with his chairman. Villa went on to win the European Cup, was a prolific striker as a player as well. Takaro Road, Norwich 1, Sheffield United 2. Sheffield United still unbeaten away from home this season, but that was their first win in 5, coming back from a goal down at half-time. By all accounts, Chris Wilder went a bit blue in the half-time interval. He said if there was a swear jar, it'd be in the hundreds. and 2 goals in 3 minutes from their wing-backs, an Ender Stevens header and a great turn and hit from George Baldock. The game ended with fans from both sides singing anti-VAR songs. It's not football anymore. This probably comes from Sheffield United being totally VAR'd against Newcastle on Thursday night when everybody stopped, including even Jonjo Shelvey,
yeah,
but still just sort of put it in and they scored the goal. But they had, for the first time ever in the Premier League, a red card being overturned. Chris Basham, which to me looked like a red card that should have been a red card, just because he didn't break the guy's leg because he missed it. He still absolutely flew in like a nutcase.
Yeah, I mean, I think he was lucky that on the replays, actually, he didn't seem to make much contact. There was a lot of chat on Match of Day 2 last night about it being reckless, which would mean it was a yellow card, and it was definitely reckless, but actually he didn't really make much contact. And I think over the past few seasons, obviously before VAR came in, there'd been this kind of tendency to just send a player off if they're just running in at speed. It was just this guaranteed, you know, any single time a player was coming in low, slide tackle and coming in at speed, it would be a sending off guaranteed, regardless of if they actually made much contact. And I guess maybe one of the few plus sides of VAR is that you will maybe get second looks at sendings off and realise that actually, yes, it was probably a stupid thing to do, but did he make much contact in the end? No.
I don't think contact matters.
The issue with this is that, I mean, this is the first time this has happened in the Premier League with a red being turned into a yellow, and now it's happened once, you're going to see it. It's just going to open up a can of worms where every red card is going to be scrutinised much. And it's subjective, so there's no right answer. So you're going to have some fans and managers who are going to be livid it hasn't been overturned when it's marginal.
We have to remember that it's the first season of it in the Premier League. You look at the Bundesliga and Serie A, where they had it, and it, you know, if you read the newspapers and magazines in those countries at the time, you would see that the arguments against them were just as voracious, but I think they've calmed down and people have got used to it. Funnily enough, I think I've got used to it now, but it's taken a while.
Newcastle were the beneficiaries of VAR on Thursday night. They won again yesterday. Paul says, can somebody please try to explain Newcastle for me? We're generally poor most weeks. Our three strikers have two goals between them all season, yet somehow we have 22 points. That's one less than Spurs. How is this happening? Statistically, we surely aren't the 10th best team in the league.
They pretty much only need to win five more games all season to stay up, which is pretty much the target for Newcastle at the start of the season. Point made by Louise Taylor in today's paper. The crowd was only 42,303. I saw Steve Bruce talk afterwards about how the fans are now on his side, but they're not there in the numbers that they have been previously. About those strikers, Andy Carroll's cross for John Joe Shelby.
In a hilarious role reversal, wasn't it?
But I've often found this, that good headers of the ball can be good crosses of the ball. Alan Shearer, do you remember, was a great cross of the ball?
Okay.
Romelu Lukaku isn't too bad at crossing the ball. There must be some sort of interface between the
big
two.
Big dunk? I feel like Harry Kane's corners for England all those years ago just kind of levels the balance a bit.
Well, yes, that's true. That is true. But what he was doing, taking it, no one will ever know.
I think the issue with Newcastle at the moment is the results are definitely paving over the cracks, and Alain Saint-Maximin has become this kind of cult hero for a couple of days at least, and he's being really funny on social media and being a bit of a joker. I mean, yesterday at the start of the match, he was looking absolutely freezing cold and jumping him down and just being genuinely quite funny. And I think that's great now, and results are going their way, but it can unravel so quickly, and the fans who are there seem to be enjoying it, and he's sort of getting them excited. But, you know, at the end, there's still so many issues with that team.
I was at Villa Park for the game a couple of weeks ago, and I don't think I've ever seen a worse Premier League team before as Newcastle were that night. They showed no intent at all to attack. Even when they went 1-0 down, there was just no intent at all, except for let's hope that Saint-Maximin can use his pace to get down the left. You know, Steve Bruce returning to the club that had sacked him in a year earlier, you'd have thought he'd be desperate to get a result there. They were absolutely desperate. And, you know, they've scored 17 goals this season and they're on 22 points, which is mind-boggling. And I think it's lucky for them they've got their 22 points on the board.
Danny Ings is a real bright spark for them. He scored in five Premier League games in a row, the first time in his career. He's already on his second highest return in the top flight, two behind his 11 for Burnley five seasons ago. And Ryan Bertrand had a massive chance, didn't he, at 1-1. So this could have gone either way, I guess, this one.
Yes, I'm getting a bit concerned about Ralph Hasenhüttl, though. He's beginning to look a bit befuddled in his post-match. And bit when a manager shrugs the shoulders in the manner that he did watching it back last night, you begin to get a bit concerned. He's under pressure. Southampton aren't exactly known for patience. And it was about this time last year, in fact, that he got the job, isn't it? So the problem, I do think, is that he's not working with the best group of players in the world. And they were a little bit unlucky in this game as well.
To the Amex, and Brighton and Wolves very thoughtfully decided to not bother starting playing until the Scottish League Cup final had finished. So excellent for the armchair viewer. Then suddenly four goals in 16 minutes. And really, they could have just stopped at half time. There was sort of no need for the rest of the game. It was a fun 16 minutes, though.
Oh yeah, it was great fun. When I saw the score, I presumed there must have been some goals at least in the second half. And then I was watching the highlights, and I realised, oh wait, they're still both shooting to the same end. Oh, there's nothing more to come from this. And there's something so kind of unassuming about Graham Potter. I mean, I saw him a couple of times, you know, when Swansea, when he was managing them, and I was impressed by him. But it's his lack of celebration, which I find really surprising. It's almost that he doesn't want to acknowledge much success. It's just, yeah, that was meant to happen. That's how we score goals. And very few other managers do that. And it's this sort of, it plays into his aura of, you know, I am this uber intelligent genius, which I'm not saying he isn't, but I've just never seen a manager just sort of stand there and say, yeah, job done.
I wasn't totally across, you know, everything he did at Ostersund's as well. Did he ever celebrate? Do we know if he's ever celebrated anything, or he's just sort of, you know, his heartbeat once a minute and he's just
he's so
very
calm, yeah,
very level through everything.
Very, very calm. I mean, Chris Hughton wasn't, you know, particularly
he wasn't
sort of
bouncing
chaotic
up the walls, was he?
No, so I think it probably suits that club to have the kind of calmness in the dressing room. I think Brighton, you know, getting Neil Maupay was brilliant at Brentford. I think that's been, you know, such a good purchase for them, because even though Glenn Murray was becoming kind of reliable, they needed someone a bit sharper, a bit younger, unfortunately, for Murray. And this has been, you know, an ideal solution. Brighton are such a funny club, because I just feel like they're going to be Stoke in the Premier League for a while. And then I don't.
But better
really,
than.
But, you know, better.
I think. I think the ambitions. I mean, Tony Bloom, who owns Brighton, has the bank balance to support a Premier League team, and he, you know, he's a guy who made his money through gambling in football, so he understands the game of football very, very well. And that was the funny thing in the summer when people were criticising him for getting rid of Chris Hughton. I mean, there's probably no one better qualified in seeing trends and how football teams are going than a guy who's made his money from literally predicting what football teams are going to do. And with Graham Potter, they brought in someone who's invests so much in the process of how to win games of football and the method by which doing it, and bring in players that fit his passing style of football. They have so many good centre-backs at the club. I mean, they've got Duncan Webster, who are playing at the moment. They've got Ben White, who's out on loan at Leeds. They've got Matt Clark as well, who's out on loan at Derby. I think that Brighton are kind of, I guess, going under the radar of a club whose ambitions are much, much loftier than just survival in the Premier League.
And a 6'7" left back in Dan Byrne, which is great fun.
Always
isn't
fun,
it?
Yeah.
As Paul said, is this genius or lunacy? I can't work out if having a really tall left back is a good idea, but it seems to be working. And he's good. He's got a good touch for a big man, hasn't he? Watford 0, Crystal Palace 0. Nigel Pearson is the new Watford manager. It seems like quite a sensible choice, since he was the last guy who managed to save a team from the brink. It's almost like the Pozzo family just went, who was the last person that got a team out of absolute...
Yeah, we were talking about this in the office on Friday, and I saw quite a lot of Leicester's games that season under Nige. But what is forgotten is that it was Nige that got him in that trouble in the first place that season.
That's a good point.
I was also actually present at the famous ostrich incident.
Oh, were you?
Yeah. Now, funnily enough, Ian Baker, the reporter... who was the subject of that particular rant.
Call him like a fat man or something like that?
Well, he said that there was a reference to the fact that Ian isn't the most athletic of people. And then he said something about, can you put your head in the sand? I bet you can't, and all this type of thing. But I was there, and I don't know, we go to press conferences and you're typing up the quotes, and, you know, there's Twitter and there's people messaging at the same time. And I suddenly looked up and realised what was going on. And at first it seemed funny, and then it was like, actually, this is pretty horrible. And a couple of the more senior reporters were saying, Nigel, you can't do this. So it was one of those incidents that has always stuck with me. Nigel Pearson has in press conferences, has this technique, which is someone will ask him a question and he will reply very slowly and think about his answers before delivering not much. I mean, and it's he'll be good value. He is good value. He hasn't really had a great time since leaving Leicester, though.
You go to Belgium or something?
To Belgium, which was a club owned by the same people that own Leicester. A spell at Derby, which everyone's been on the ejector seat there.
Well. Yeah, I mean, what I would say, shameless plug here, but we did an interview with him on the podcast, a one-on-one special about 6 months ago. It was done by Ali, my podcast partner, let's call him. And Nigel Pearson, I think after this little break is we might see a bit of a different side to him. He seems to have relaxed a bit. I think the intensity may have softened a little bit, at least to start with. And yeah, if you want to look, kind of find out a bit more about the man, I'd recommend listening to it, because I think it's quite surprising, some of his answers and the way that he approached it.
Apparently Louis van Gaal was the fat man thing. Was that another fat man thing?
Well, that was to a Sun journalist, Neil Custis.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. Anyway, it was nice to know where Hayden Mullins was, because I didn't know.
Yeah.
And now I know.
Well, sometimes certain things make you feel old, and the fact that Hayden Mullins can be a caretaker manager is one of those things.
Sam says, now that Nigel Pearson is back, does he retain his title of hardest Premier League manager, or is it Big Dunk? For reference, I believe the current holder prior to the recent sackings is Sean Dyche, although Daniel Farke could be considered for the spot. I wouldn't have Farke in there. No. I mean, I would like to see a Royal Rumble. Now Pearson's back with Ferguson. Dyche.
It's got to be Nige v Dunk, hasn't it?
Absolutely. Now, tonight, West Ham play Arsenal. On Thursday night, Arsenal lost at home to Brighton. Brighton had 20 shots to Arsenal's 12. From Albinio, Arsenal have allowed their opponents 253 shots this season. Man City allowed just 238 shots in the whole of last season. Arsenal haven't kept a clean sheet for 2 months. From Charles Watts, Arsenal have conceded 82 shots in 3 games this season against Watford, Southampton and Brighton. In the same games, they've had just 31 shots themselves. I mean, the Big Dunk new manager bounce, there has not been a Freddie Ljungberg big manager bounce, new manager bounce, something manager bounce, has there? There is no bouncing.
He doesn't bounce on the sidelines. Maybe that's the problem.
But they were, I mean, Brighton were really good,
yes,
in that game against Arsenal, but you just expect more. I don't know why. I don't know if I should or not. You just expect something.
Yeah, I mean, there seems to me just they Arsenal lack leaders in that team, and it's a cliche, and it's something that you can't really quantify. But at the same time, you look at that team and there's no one on that pitch who you could look at and think is going to be able to, you know, grab them and drag them back to performing at the level they need to be performing at. You look at what's going on in the manager search, there's basically no talk of who. I mean, there's a talk of a 12-man shortlist, but they don't seem to be closer to anyone. The bookies have Arteta and Vieira as the two favourites, so that suggests that there's a lack of planning again, and if it doesn't work out with Ljungberg, they'll give it to another ex-player. And whoever comes in is going to have their work cut out, because there's enough talent in this team. I mean, you look at someone like Matteo Guendouzi, who I think is a kind of elite-level talent who'll play, you know, he'll go on to have a fantastic career, but it's impossible for him to do his job if there isn't the calm nature or that defensive midfielder alongside him, or someone who can just stop them from being so easy to play against.
West Ham are odd, aren't they? I mean, they sometimes turn up and sometimes they don't. If they don't and Arsenal don't, this has all the chances of being the most toothless game of football it's ever been. Football League times. 6 wins in a row for West Brom. They smashed Swansea 5-1. Leeds just 2 points behind after a 2-0 win at Huddersfield. Fulham in third are 8 points further back. They lost 2-1 at home to Bristol City, who are now level on points with the Cottagers. They pulled one back in the 86th minute. Fulham had an amazing penalty shout turned down and then hit the bar. Lots of Fulham fans, George, very upset about that penalty shout.
Yeah, I think, and probably rightly so. But I mean, this Fulham team, we were asked last week about, you know, Fulham, West Brom, Leeds, is that the top three? But I think Fulham are way off those two teams, especially defensively.
Can we have an FFP update from Sheffield Wednesday?
Yeah, we're waiting at the moment to find out what the sanctions are going to be. There's talk of a 21-point deduction for Sheffield Wednesday for the deal where the owner, Chancery, bought the stadium, but seemingly they broke some FFP rules around that. They had the Sheffield Wednesday fans singing, "With Sheffield Wednesday, we do what we want" on Saturday. I don't think they do what they want, because they're going to get a sanction. So I'm not sure that really works. But Gary Monk is
that
doing...
not a defence? Can you not play that to
well,
the...
We are Sheffield Wednesday, we do what we want.
Could
okay.
play that to the court.
But Gary Monk's doing a fantastic job there, so it's going to be galling for him. He seems to be a manager who sometimes will create his own bad luck, but also ends up in positions where, you know, he's taken the Sheffield Wednesday team onto the edge of the playoffs in sixth position. Yet again, I mean, he's got an incredible record with strikers, Gary Monk. I think if you're a striker, you want to play under him. Think back to Che Adams and Djukovic last season. Chris Wood, of course, he basically made his career at Leeds. Even Wilfred Bonny at Swansea. And Stephen Fletcher's the latest to profit from that. But it seems like soon, instead of being on the edge of the playoffs, they're going to be looking at a relegation battle. But given how well they're playing, they should be fine.
At the bottom, filthy Luton staged a big comeback at home to Wigan. 1-0 down in the 87th minute, they won 2-1. In League One, leaders Wickham didn't play. Ipswich in second drew at Coventry. Lovely tweet from their striker, James Norwood. I've been in my house since July the 2nd, and 5 minutes ago, I noticed I have a tumble dryer. Sunderland are 11th. They lost at Gillingham. Jack says, Phil Parkinson, what's the point? Why has Sunderland's complete demise been relatively unspoken of in the national media as a whole? I mean, sitting often in between Wilson and Barry, I would disagree with that. He said, it's no Barry, but compare it to the furore around Ashley, only spending about 100 million on forwards in the last year at Newcastle. And it's striking. They are Phil Parkinson's starters.
This is Sunderland, who spent 4 million quid on Will Grigg in January, and they're complaining about spending.
Jack appears to be.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of issues at Sunderland, and, you know, Phil Parkinson has made a shocking start, but I think it's the manner with which the squad's been built rather than a lack of spending that's the key to that.
Stop Campbell Southend were 2 up at half-time but lost 4-2 to Bristol Rovers. Soles said he did not understand what world these guys are living in after the game. In League 2, Forest Green Rovers are investigating a report of racist abuse directed at a Scunthorpe United player during Saturday's game at the New Lawn. The game was temporarily stopped by the ref. A stadium announcement was relayed to the crowd in the wake of the incident. Rovers said a single fan was being investigated for comments directed at Scunthorpe player Jordan Clark. In a statement on Twitter, Forest Green said, we do not tolerate racism and the ongoing investigation will end with a lifetime ban if found guilty. Forest Green slipped to third after losing that game. Swindon are 3 points clear at the top. They won 3-0 at Grimsby. Exeter into second. Cambridge stuffed Plymouth 1-0. The Colin Calderwood revolution continues. Can we have the opposition manager's quotes, please, George Ellick?
Yeah, so Ryan Lowe, Plymouth manager, said that his side couldn't live with Cambridge United in the first half.
They couldn't.
And Cambridge were the best team by a mile. So
yeah, the league doesn't lie.
Hasn't, I don't think anyone said that about Cambridge since about 1998.
Since 1991, I would suggest. Macclesfield's game didn't go ahead. Ben says, what is George's reaction to the majority shareholder of Macclesfield finally deciding to sell his share? What's the latest?
Well, I mean, the talk is that he's going to sell his share. I think actions, as ever, with owners who aren't particularly popular with the club's fans speak louder than words.
There was a statement Friday,
yeah,
which is, you know, when a game gets called off for the fact that players won't play is a deeply depressing moment, especially when the Bury and Bolton cases this season. I am a Macclesfield fan, and there is a certain optimism that he may sell. Whether that's Joe Seeley, who I've discussed on the pod before, is a different issue. It appears that Amar, the owner, or the majority owner, wanted to have the game staged despite the fact that the players were on strike, which is some going, really, and then eventually had to come to his senses. So maybe the EFL pressure and the pressure of the players might be brought to bear here. I have concerns over what they might find when should a takeover go through. But it's better than what's been going on at the moment.
I think looking back at the Bury and Bolton situations, at Bury there were plenty of false dawns of talk of Steve Sale selling the club to potential owners that never came through.
Yes.
The Bolton scenario with Football Ventures, it was so long. It took so long to go through. I'm just urging some caution, I guess, that a statement on Friday from Amar saying that he's going to sell doesn't necessarily mean that he has sold, and fingers crossed it gets sorted out as soon as possible, because there are likely going to be sanctions after them being unable to field a team on Saturday, which isn't going to help anyone, whether that's financial or a points deduction. And I think we all just hope that the situation can be sorted as soon as possible so Macclesfield can get back to playing football and try and, you know, maintain their EFL status.
On a significantly less important note, Joel says, on your issue with boring goal nets the other day, and lots of people were very exercised by our goal net discussion, red and white spotted at Morecambe on Saturday. They are still bottom, though, of League 2. In the WSL, big clash at the top this weekend was between two of the last three champions as Chelsea beat Man City 2-1. A brilliant goal from Caroline Weir to get it started for City. Chelsea came back from behind to score twice in 3 minutes. City had only conceded once in their first 8 games. Flo, you were there.
I was, and that stat is even more impressive because City are playing a forward at right back, so they're improvising, to say the least. But yeah, Chelsea are just ruthless this season, and everything is sort of going the right way, and I think they will come away with the title. They also have a game in hand because their game against Everton was called off last weekend. So,
and Sam Kerr is yet to turn up.
And Sam Kerr is, yes, yet to turn up, and Bethany England is in exceptional form. A lot of the conversation's been about Vivian Miedema, who has got 12 goals. Now Bethany England and Lauren James are the next best with 5, but England's in such good form that I see Chelsea holding on and carrying through to claim the title this season for sure.
Sam Kerr was named best women's footballer of the year by The Guardian last week. Are you happy with that decision?
I'm happy with that. I know on the last pod and, you know, on Twitter there's been lots of conversations about whether, you know, Rapinoe should have won Ballon d'Or, and I think Kerr as a whole is kind of, you know, she's got scoring records in both the Australian and US domestic leagues, as well as, you know, being a star for her country. I think because of, you know, Australia not doing as well as they possibly could have at the World Cup, it meant that other players were kind of got a bit more of a profile, and obviously the US took the title, so Rapinoe became this kind of, you know, icon for a lot of people, and I completely agree with that. But I think in a kind of footballing scenario, Miedema or Kerr are probably, you know, the best in the world.
Arsenal won 3-0 at Reading. Some lovely goals in there. Miedema scored a chip and a lob. Subtle differences between the two.
Kim Little's goal was just unreal.
Describe it.
So I would say it's shades of Jack Wilshere against Norwich, that incredible team goal that Arsenal scored all those years ago. And it's just a fantastic... It came for a corner, Beth Mead puts the ball in, Williamson takes a touch back to Little, Little plays it back to Williamson, Williamson then kind of chips it to Little, who takes one touch and volleys it in. A fantastic, fantastic goal.
Yeah, it's a delight. Manchester United beat Everton 3-1. Bad first 2 minutes for United keeper Mary Earps, who spilled across and put it out for a corner before punching the delivery into her own net. Then United came back. Lauren James, a sister of Reese, scoring twice and winning a penalty. Fitbar, Jim says, after yesterday's Betfred final, what's the biggest robbery in cup final history? This game was so much fun. The last 20 minutes, Rangers 0, Celtic 1. One shot on target all game for Celtic, the winning goal, which was offside. Fraser Forster was utterly immense in the Celtic goal. He saved an Alfredo Morelos penalty, who has missed a few, actually. Lots of people saying Tavernier should have taken it. Morelos had a great chance late on. It was absolutely bucketing with rain. Challenges flying in from everywhere.
Steven Gerrard has been praised for the job he's done with Rangers, and I don't think we could doubt that he has done a decent job there. But at this point, do we begin to question whether he's a lucky general or not? There is something about Steven that sort of... There's a tragic element to him, isn't there? A guy whose career, it's about to be one of the best players of the last 30 years, is defined by a failure. they were the better team in that game.
Oh, they were so much better.
And then just couldn't get it done.
Just for balance, Stuart Weir, the journalist and broadcaster, saying, you know, Rangers 0, Celtic 1, winners find ways of winning, but isn't it great Scottish football has stuck with tradition, dismissing VAR as an expensive gimmick and instead championing incompetence? So, you know, there are arguments on both sides. But I mean, Danny Baker's point is true. It was so relentless, and it was so... And I suppose it was a bit... It was a different game to that Carabao Cup game between Arsenal and Liverpool. But when you were just like, oh, well, that's a goal. That's been given. We crack on. That look, after the penalty was missed, Scott Arfield absolutely cleaned someone out. And you were like, VAR's got to check. Oh, it's not there. So that's all right.
But I mean, for balance, though, because the first half of the Manchester derby was also a brilliant spectacle, like end-to-end pulsating game. And there was a correct VAR decision for the penalty.
Very true.
So
is this what you're going to do now when... You'd be planning your Sunday, Saturday viewing. Well, this game won't have VAR, so I'm going to watch that instead of those fancy down Premier League.
It's possible. I mean, it was definitely the best game on yesterday, that is for sure. That'll do for part two. We'll begin part three with Sid in Spain. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, tremendous. Thanks very much. So Barcelona beat Mallorca 5-2. Really nice hat-trick from Messi, but no time for that when we can talk about the move and the finish for their fourth.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, funnily enough, I mentioned this on, what night would it be? Wednesday night. Just watched the highlights of the Merseyside derby. And I genuinely thought, wow, I don't think I've seen a team score as well, it doesn't need to be five, but you know, five or six or four, and score five such brilliant goals before him, which all of the goals are brilliant.
Yeah.
And to use, as I think the kids say these days, Barcelona went, hold my beer, and turned up and produced, you know, just a ridiculous collection of goals. And as you say, Messi scores this brilliant hat trick, which of course, you know, it's Messi, so brilliant hat trick. Yeah, Messi, what's next? Who cares? Partly because it was overshadowed by just a brilliant, brilliant goal from Luis Suarez. A really, really nice move. And probably the most outstanding thing about this game was that Barcelona seemed to be enjoying it. They were moving the ball freely against, it's got to be said, a pretty poor team. But the move was brilliant. And the finish from Suarez, it's a back heel, but it's more than just a back heel, because he's turned away from goal. And he was asked about this afterwards, and he said it was entirely deliberate. And he back heels the ball into the ground so that it pops up. It's almost like a kind of a, I don't know, like a trick shot in snooker almost. So it pops up and past the goalkeeper into the far corner. It's just sensational.
It's lovely, isn't it? And 5-2, Barcelona's most common scoreline this season, which is completely
home,
ludicrous.
Yeah. Yeah, it is ridiculous. There's quite a lot of ridiculous stats to come out of this one. I mean, there's been three 5-2s. There was a 5-1. So obviously, you know, if only they'd been a little bit worse at defending that day, we'd have another one. There was a 4-0, and I might be wrong in this, but I think there might be a 4-1 in there as well, although obviously I've lost count because these are high numbers now. But also, take Leo Messi. Leo Messi, who after week 7 had no goals in La Liga. He started the season injured, even when he came back, he wasn't quite right. He's now top scorer.
So good, isn't he? Real 1-2-0, they're joint top with Barca, but a couple of injuries.
Yeah, I mean, they've got problems. Well, in this game, they didn't have either Hazard or Gareth Bale. Of course, the focus is all on the Clásico. So much so, actually, that the kind of the build-up to Clásico has started already now, and all of the papers have gone on the shape that the two teams are in building up to Clásico, even though it's not the next game. And they both play really difficult games as well at the weekend. They've got Champions League games in midweek, which matter a little bit less because they're both through. And then at weekend, Barcelona go away to Real Sociedad, Real Madrid go away to Valencia. Then they play the Clásico next Wednesday. Now, Bale and Hazard both unavailable this week, but the big thing really is that Hazard almost certainly won't make it to the Clásico. Bale, we think, probably will. But Real Madrid have had a couple of big injury problems going into this weekend's games and probably going into the Clásico. But they're starting to play well, Real Madrid. And I think both sides now, after this weekend, will feel that OK, maybe this Clásico's arrived at a point at which they're starting to find the football, although, of course, then the Clásico will define that, will really test that. Madrid, a bit like Barcelona, playing against a team who are really aren't very good, but actually play pretty well. And as I say, they've started to find their feet in the last few weeks, and in particular, Karim Benzema is playing exceptionally.
Yeah, just a goal behind Messi at the scoring charts. Atleti shared a goalless draw with Villarreal on Friday night. They've drawn half of their games this season, 8-16.
Yeah, and I've just been sent a stat by a friend of mine, which I didn't know. Atletico Madrid have now had 50 shots without scoring.
Wow.
It is partly they're not taking chances. It's partly that the chances that they create are perhaps not clear enough and there aren't enough of them. And this obviously comes in the context of the back of last week when they were beaten by Barcelona. And Simeone after the game said, look, this is a transitional season, which breaks his normal discourse when he talks about a game at a time and always being competing and always trying to see where you are at the end of the season rather than having an idea about what you're trying to achieve. He then backed away from that a little bit, or at least tried to define it a bit in midweek when he said, look, I said transitional season, but, you know, transition doesn't mean just sitting there and waiting for the flowers to grow in your garden. You know, you're still doing things. But they're not scoring enough goals. I do think, though, the fact that they're not losing games means that in knockout competitions, even if they probably won't pick up sufficient points to genuinely compete for the league, in knockout competitions, I still think they're going to be really, really difficult to beat.
And Joachim, oldest player to score a hat-trick in La Liga.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know which of these ludicrous facts you like the best, but this is just... So let's try and give you some of the ludicrous facts, right? Joaquin comes onto the pitch against Athletic Bilbao, the team with the best defensive record in La Liga this season, and he scores after 1 minute and 28 seconds. He scores a second 9 minutes later and scores a third 9 minutes after that. So in other words, 20 minutes into this game, he's already scored a quarter of all the goals that Athletic have conceded this season, which is pretty silly in itself. Then you can add some other things into this. It's his first ever hat-trick. And he says afterwards, well, I think it'll be my last. It's taken him this long to get it. He's 38 years old. He's older than anyone on the pitch, including the referee. You know, he's this is in the week in which, of course, Messi at the Ballon d'Or said that he was thinking about retiring. You know, they've mentioned for the first time that phrase that terrified everyone. Oh, blimey, Messi's going to go. It's coming to the end. And Joaquin was asked about this the day after. He said, well, he obviously hasn't got my physique, has he? Joaquin is 38. He's the oldest player ever to get a hat-trick in La Liga. He's the player with the most victories in La Liga of anyone in history, apart from, who hasn't played for Madrid, Barcelona or Atletico Madrid. He scores this hat-trick. He then gets a chance for a fourth in the 91st minute, and he hits it straight at the goalkeeper. And he said afterwards that his manager said to him, all you needed to do was put the brakes on and control it and you'd have scored. And he said at that point in the game, if I stop, I'll just fall over. I haven't got any legs left and it's the end. And so this is, you know, I think the other thing about Joaquin, and for those in England who don't know him, when people talk about Joaquin in Spain, they talk about a comedian as much as they do a footballer, because this is a guy who loves to crack jokes, who's been on telly trying to hypnotise a chicken. There's a great photograph of him celebrating Betis winning the Copa del Rey in 2004, I think it is, which tells you how long he's been around. You know, this is his 21st season as a professional. In 2004, he's celebrating the Copa del Rey, just standing there wearing absolutely nothing. And just kind of, you know, everything's hanging out, celebrating the Copa del Rey, which he then took to his wedding and put at the altar at his wedding, I think 2 days later. He's always seen as this guy who cracks jokes. And I think what makes this nice is that this is another reminder that kind of obsession we have with being serious and not being silly and not being frivolous is just total bollocks. You know, you can be someone who's got a bit of a personality and still be bloody brilliant at football and still be playing at 38. And by the way, this week, he was negotiating his contract renewal with Betis to the age of 40. So I suspect they might sign him up now.
We always do number one on this day for young players. On the day Joaquin was born, number one was Ghost Town by The Specials.
Oh, good one.
Was he successful in hypnotising a chicken?
Well, he claimed that the chicken wasn't very willing on this particular occasion.
You always get an unwilling chicken at the worst times.
What actually happened was he's sort of stroking it and saying, come on, it's okay. And this chicken did relax, but I don't know if it went quite so far as to actually be hypnotized. I mean, it didn't think it was a cow or anything like that. Joaquin, of course, has a secret. The reason that he's lasted so long, he was breastfed until he was seven. And he thinks that is why he's so strong.
Oh, that sounds slightly curious to me.
There's a great quote from him. I love this quote as well. He said, you know, we would all play in the square near where I lived. And when the game stopped, everyone would run for the water fountain except me. Oh. And I would run straight to my mother's chest.
Relaxing a chicken is a different TV show to hypnotising a chicken, isn't it? Sid, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Cheerio.
Tidlo out in Spain there. To Germany, Bayern Munich lost for a second game in a row. 2-1 at league leaders Borussia Mönchengladbach. It was a really fun game this. Thomas Müller missed an open goal at 0-0. Jan Sommer, the Gladbach keeper, spilled a shot from Kimmich. Stopped it with his fingertips with most, I'd say 99% of the ball over the line. Perisic scored the opener for Bayern with a nice left-footed volley on the turn. Almost hit it too well. Then Gladbach left-back Rami Bensebaini scored a header, bullet header, a 92nd minute penalty to keep his side top. The penalty came after a ridiculous foul from Javi Martinez, who'd already been booked and then jumped in two-footed, got his second yellow, despite only coming on with half an hour left. A point behind them, RB Leipzig, manager Julian Nagelsmann facing his old club Hoffenheim for the first time, beating them 3-1. Timo Werner scored two. He's up to 15 for the season now, one behind Robert Lewandowski. And Borussia Dortmund had a good weekend, beating Fortuna Dusseldorf 5-0. Jadon Sancho scored two, set up another, as did Marco Reus. They now sit third, 5 points off the top and 2 points ahead of Bayern. From Germany, we go to Italy and Juventus' first league defeat of the season. Here's Nicky Bandini.
Yes, indeed. Juventus' first defeat of the season and Lazio's first home win over Juve for 16 years. It was all inspired by Luis Alberto, who set up Lazio's equaliser and also the goal that put them ahead after they had fallen behind to a Cristiano Ronaldo goal in the first half. Lazio benefited from some situations going their way. Rodrigo Bentancur got injured before half-time when the score was still 1-0, and I think he was a big loss to Juventus. Juan Cuadrado then got himself a really silly red card with the scores at 1-1, initially yellow, but corrected to a red on a VAR review. So VAR doing something right in this one. Lazio did go for the jugular after that, to their credit, I thought, because lots of teams haven't in similar situations against Juventus. Luis Alberto releasing Sergej Milinkovic-Savic with a lovely ball over the top for the second goal. And Milinkovic-Savic taking it really wonderfully, controlling it on his right foot and then finishing on his second touch with the left. Moments after that, Matsu win a penalty. Chesney should get sent off, but doesn't. Stays on, saves the penalty. Still time for Juventus' comeback, but Lazio instead get another goal from Felipe Caicedo in injury time. So, big result. Big result because Inter had drawn with Roma the night before, so it's a missed chance for Juventus to go back top of the table. But it's also a win for Lazio that might just bring them into the title race. They've won 7 games in a row now. They're only 5 points off first, 3 behind Juve, and they have the best goal difference in the division, plus 21 after 15 games. And of course, yes, Luis Alberto, Milinkovic Savic, Ciro Immobile and Joaquin Correa all playing really well under Simone Inzaghi. So many great options going forwards. It's obviously a good result for Inter too, since it keeps them top. They had the chances to win against Roma, but just couldn't quite take them. The subplot to that story, of course, is that it was the game that pitted Romelu Lukaku and Chris Smalling against each other after the horribly misjudged Black Friday headline in Corriere dello Sport on Thursday. Both players issued strong criticisms of that headline, while Roma and Milan have both banned the newspaper from their training facilities until the end of 2019. But Corriere dello Sport's editor, Ivan Zazzaroni, only doubled down over the weekend, accusing the headline's critics of willfully poisoning the discourse and making a laboured point in these issues that about all the times the paper had condemned racism in the past, also publishing quotes from friends and colleagues who had spoken out in support. So, to put it another way, making it clear that, in his view, the only victims were himself and his paper. But Smalling and Lukaku clearly unfazed by it on the pitch. Smalling had a really good game, actually. Lukaku just couldn't quite get the finish. They shared a hug on the pitch at full time.
Thank you, Nikki. In France, PSG came back from behind to win 3-1 at Montpellier. Neymar, Mbappe and Icardi all scoring after the home side's Pedro Mendes, not that one, was sent off. Monaco won 3-0 against Amiens, 3 wins in 4, up to 11th after a dreadful start to the season. Best moment of the game when Keita Balde-Diao was being subbed off. His number is 14, the number which used to be used by Timu Bakayoko, back on loan from Chelsea. So Bakayoko starts running off and applauding the fans before someone points out that he's not wearing number 14 anymore. He finds it all very funny and everyone had a nice time. Marseille stay second, 5 points behind. They now won 6 in a row under André Villas-Boas.
Yeah, I saw a bit of this game. It's André Villas-Boas. He feels like someone from another dimension. It was a figure I used to see regularly crouched. He remember he had that crouch.
He was so young. He was like 32 when he was.
He's now like 41 or something. But yeah, but he would crouch on the sidelines. It was like this special vantage point that he would have, and he was always moving his hands as if he was controlling it like a
Ouija board.
Well, like a Ouija board or one of those sort of Bluetooth computer games where you control...
Or like Minority Report.
Yeah.
Okay, right. Glad we got there with the analogy.
Yeah, well, it seems he's still got it within him, though.
Oh, good. Some breaking news. Russia have been given a 4-year ban from all major sporting events, which includes the 2022 World Cup. Unclear how they'd work it currently, but there is precedent for a team of Russian athletes competing under a neutral banner. Russia will still be able to play in Euro 2020, as WADA doesn't consider that to be a major competition. So, we'll see how that progresses. Chess news. Magnus Carlsen, the world's best chess player for the last decade, is on the brink of reaching the top of the Fantasy Football League. The FPL game has 7 million players worldwide, and he's in third place after Saturday's results. The 29-year-old reigning world chess champion tops an elite FPL made up solely of chess grandmasters. Where is Nigel Short in that? And is dominating another where Martin Ødegaard, who's at Sociedad at the moment, is languishing near the bottom of the table. Thank you to Ed for getting in touch to say two people with famous relatives scored in the Northern Premier League this weekend. Ben Harmison, brother of Steve, scored for Morpeth, and Jake Charles, grandson of John, scored for Stafford. Paul says, I have a question. If Gary Neville's unexpected intervention isn't going to alter the course of this week's general election, which footballer could and how might they do it? This was off the back of the racist incident at the Etihad. Gary Neville was talking about the normalising of racism if the current Prime Minister is going to do it.
Yeah, he was talking about immigration, wasn't it?
There was no sort of hard Brexit Peter Shilton there for balance in the studio. But who do you think, if Gary Neville can't do it, who could do it?
I think Sean Dyche or Neil Warnock could probably swing a few votes with their hard opinions. If they went the other way, that might
have
an impact.
So do you reckon that, you know, Labour are keeping them up their sleeve just for a day before the election?
Possibly, yeah.
Could Chris Wilder swing the, I think it's the Healey constituency that the Bramall Lane's in? Footballers and politics, they don't really mix, do they?
No, I mean, I was going to say anyone at Arsenal could come out in support of one and then the other would win. So that would be...
So Bellerin comes out full Brexit.
Yeah, but then, you know, then we're all fine.
I mean, there was a drama recently. It wasn't... Who was it at Charlton who had a bit of a...
Lyle Taylor?
Was it Lyle Taylor Taylor or someone else?
It was Lyle Taylor was talking about how he should... He pays his taxes and he wants to keep his money.
And it's Carl Henry is a prominent Brexiteer, isn't he?
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
How prominent?
Well, his views are prominent on these... He has right-wing leanings, let's put it that way.
And it's Shilton v. Peter Reid and Neville Southall, and, you know...
It has to be said, Big Nev and Reedy, who I have maximum respect for, are preaching to the converted quite a lot in that regard, aren't they? I think Peter Reid, actually, of all of them, is the most... Following his Twitter, he's incredibly switched on with politics.
He really is. James says, is Barry still alive? The latest from Barry. I just kayaked around the Arabian Sea. I don't think he did the whole of it. He said, twice yesterday, morning and evening. Between that, swimming, walking and eating fish all the time. There is actually a danger of me getting mildly fit over the next couple of weeks. I very much doubt it. But anyway, that'll do for today. Oh, he says, I also got recognised walking down the street in Palalem, Goa, by a Football Weekly fan named Tom, who asked for a selfie, much to the bewilderment of his completely baffled girlfriend. Thank you, Tom, and thanks for listening. And thanks for your time. Thank you, John.
Cheers, Max.
Thank you, George.
Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Flo.
Thanks, Max.
I'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.